Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Right now, Hoda Muthanna is in a Syrian refugee camp with her toddler son. She wants to come home to her family in Alabama. But not long ago, Muthanna was an avowed Islamic State militant in Syria, willing the caliphate's triumph, calling for American blood. But now she says it was all an ignorant error, that she was brainwashed.
When I came here and I saw everything with my own eyes, I realized that I made a big mistake. And I know I ruined my future and my son's future, and I'm deeply, deeply regretting it.
Muthanna also says she's willing to face justice once back in the United States, but that willingness and regret are not enough in the eyes of the Trump administration. The president tweeted that Muthanna will not be allowed back into the United States, and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says Muthanna is not a U.S. citizen, though she was born in New Jersey. Now, nations are already contending with this question of how to repatriate foreign fighters who joined ISIS and were later captured or repented. Most of them have been men, but now the question is expanding to several high-profile cases involving women and the children they've had while with the Islamic State. So this hour on Point, women, the Islamic State, and what to do when they want to come home. And you can join us. What do you think the right move is here? Bring Muthanna home, make her face justice, perhaps use it as an opportunity to gather key intelligence? Could she also become a champion of de-radicalization? Or are the dangers of repatriating someone once so deeply embedded with the Islamic State simply too great? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We're going to start today in Beirut, Lebanon, with Martin Chulov, Middle East correspondent for The Guardian. He interviewed Hoda Muthanna, the woman we're speaking about, and recently at the Syrian refugee camp where Muthanna is. We have a link to Martin's reporting at onpointradio.org. Martin Chulov, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you.
So first of all, Martin, can you tell us a little bit about how it is that you got to meet Hoda Muthanna in the refugee camp? How did you find out that she was there?
We'd known there'd been upwards of around 1,500 women and children who were in this refugee camp. There was a special section of it set aside for the wives and the family members of foreign fighters in particular. They were all foreign women. It took us 3 days to negotiate access, and once we did, we asked to speak to several individuals, and Hoda was among them. She is somebody whose case I'd been familiar with over the last 5 years. I'd been covering the rise and now the fall of the Islamic State, and she was someone of interest to me. I thought she could cast some perspectives, certainly on the trajectory of the organization and its dying days.
Mm. So tell us a little bit more, before we talk about sort of what she told you regarding her, the regret that she says she now has, tell us more about what she did when, you know, she left the United States, left Alabama and her family secretly, essentially, and traveled to first Turkey and then Syria. What did she do while being, involved with the Islamic State?
Well, she arrived sometime in early 2015 after being in a halfway house or a safe house on the Turkish border. She crossed. She made her way to Raqqa in early 2015. And very quickly, she found herself married to an Australian jihadist. She was caught up in the Australian community. There were cantonments in Raqqa. There were Americans, there were British. But because she married an Australian, she ended up in that community. And she took to her social media posts. She was a very vocal proponent of the Islamic State and its behavior at the time. She incited heavily against America. She called for attacks on Patriots Day, Veterans Day, military parades, and she was a full-blooded enthusiast of ISIS propaganda, and probably one of its noisiest agitators throughout 2015.
Hmm. You know, when we say that she found herself married to a foreign ISIS fighter here, I have to say I want to try to avoid sort of the reductive narratives that come along with. And I'm not saying that you're doing this, Martin, but I think in the coverage overall we've seen so far in cases like this, the narrative tends to get reduced to these phrases like ISIS bride, but she was a very active, you know, agent of herself. She took herself to Turkey and Syria. And as far as I understand from some of the reporting around, you know, when she got married, and she got married multiple times, that what, like she was in this dormitory, as you said, and someone came in with a list of men who wanted to get married, and the women eventually were, you know, I don't know what the process was, but they got married. They chose to get married. So it wasn't as if she was married beforehand and then went and joined ISIS.
That's right. She was single when she made a choice to go to Turkey. She made a choice to cross the border. And at the end of the day, the choice was hers as to whether she married this Australian fighter. There were choices all the way through. Once she got caught up in the system itself, she started to, after a year and a half, according to her narrative now, she started to realise it might not have lived up to her expectations. It might be more brutal and less godly than she initially thought.
Mm. Okay. So when you then met her at the Syrian refugee camp where she now is, what did she tell you about why she now feels a sense of regret?
She claimed that since late 2016, she'd started to reassess her views. She claimed that she was testing some propositions that she'd put out there on social media. She was having discussions amongst her friends, and she started to think that she may well have been brainwashed during this process, that what she was witnessing and experiencing was not what she was expecting, and it wasn't Islamic. She said despite that, she stayed with the organization. She married a second time to, again, choosing to do so, a Tunisian. She had a child with him. He died a month after getting married. The Australian jihadist had died shortly after she married him too. So by now, she was retreating with the organization towards the eastern Syrian deserts. The military offensive against them was effective. She said she was swept up in it, and she went from town to town. She couldn't leave. But by this point, 2017 and into 18, she disavowed much of the organization.
And did you find her to be sincere?
It's something I've reflected on since we spoke to her last Saturday. She made very direct eye contact. She removed her face cover, her niqab. She might have even had a bit of light makeup on, which is unusual. She was familiar and comfortable in the company of non-Muslims, and at face value, she did indeed to be sincere. Now, that may well be because she's been caught and she realises the desperate situation that she's in. But if I look at it a little closer than that, I do think there was a genuine regret that she'd been caught up in something which overwhelmed her, something which now she is not proud of. I think she has come to reassess her values, especially over the last 6 months to a year.
Okay. Now, tell us, actually, another question about sort of the timing of all this, because as you said very rightfully at the beginning of our conversation, the Islamic State is collapsing in Syria now. Does that have something to do with this? Because, you know, she was there for quite a while and, as you said, didn't necessarily make an attempt to extricate herself until relatively recently. So some might look upon this moment and saying she's expressing regret, but really what she's trying to do is get out of the Islamic State as it's falling apart in Syria.
Yes, I think standing against her narrative is that she was with them till almost the very end. Now, the case that she makes to counter that is that she couldn't leave once she was in the deepest, darkest east of Syria. Mm. It was almost impossible to escape. She said she tried twice and was shot at. And as a single woman, or even as a woman travelling in a group, it's very difficult to navigate yourself around that part of the country and to the border. So I think that stands truthfully, that it was a difficult journey, but nonetheless, 5 years with the organisation, through thick and through thin, doesn't reflect well on her, and it does eat away at her narrative, no matter how sincere she is now.
Now, when you talked with Muthanna, you recorded part of your conversation with her, and I just want to play a little bit of tape of that. And as she spoke with you, her 18-month-old son was playing at her feet. So let's listen.
I really hope America accepts me back and forgives me for my mistakes. I believe America will accept second chances, I hope. And I hope none of the people look at me as a threat. I want to come back, and I want the Americans to know that I'm not a threat, and I'm not ever coming back to the Middle East. If America were to take my passport, I would be so happy.
So that was Hora Muthana speaking to Martin Chulov of The Guardian at a Syrian refugee camp here. Martin, as you know, the president of the United States has said he's directed the State Department to not let her back into the country. And Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is also saying that she is not a U.S. citizen. There's some debate over the technicalities of that here. But right as of this moment, it looks as if the United States is not going to entertain any notion of bringing her back to face justice or not. So, I mean, obviously, all this has unfolded since you spoke with her. But can you put that in context here? How might someone in Muthana's situation react to that? How does that compare to other cases that you know of?
Well, there's a long and fraught debate right around the Western world about this. There are at least several thousand women, many hundreds more children, who are caught in virtual no man's land at the moment, those who have surrendered and they are unable to get themselves a pathway back to their home countries. It must be said that many of these women have disavowed from where they came from, and Hora Muthana was one of them. It's a difficult conversation to have politically. It's why would a politician at this point put any political capital on the line to get these people back home if they stood against this or any European state and incited against them? And that's the situation she finds herself in, as do many hundreds of others. There are French citizens there. There are British citizens as well, Canadians, Russians, those from all around Europe. And I think where the conversation starts to get some traction is on the protection obligations for the children that have been born to them. And those obligations are strong. Like, at the end of the day, these children are innocent, and they always will be innocent. And I think France have been a bit forward-leaning on this, that they say that in some cases, or as many as we can, we will take French children, but we are not going to allow their mothers to come back. There have been some exceptions to that, but not many. And other European countries are saying, well, while we acknowledge the obligations to the children, if that would just be the leading edge. If we allowed them back, then the mothers would surely follow, and that their legal positions are far more complicated. So it's a discussion at a political level that still has a long way to run, very sensitive and very difficult to reach a resolution on it.
Well, Martin Chulov, Middle East correspondent for The Guardian, speaking to us from Beirut, Lebanon. He interviewed Hora Muthana, the woman that we're talking about who joined ISIS and now says she wants to return to the United States. He interviewed her several days ago. We have a link to Martin's reporting at onpointradio.org. Martin Chulov, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
Folks, we're going to continue this conversation after a quick break. We want to know what you think. Should ISIS fighters, former ISIS fighters, who now say they regret what they've done, and in this case we're talking about women who've had children there, be allowed to come back? This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about women who joined the Islamic State in Syria. These are women who either were born in the United States or in other Western nations and now say they repent their actions and want to come home. And what their nations ought to do about it. A couple of high-profile cases really bringing the world's attention to this now. Of course, there's the American Hora Muthana that we've been talking about. And also, in the United Kingdom, the UK recently stripped the British citizenship of Shamima Begum, a young woman who went to join the Islamic State and now has implored her government to reconsider and have more sympathy for her.
It's kind of hard to swallow. yeah, it's a bit upsetting and frustrating. I feel like it's a bit unjust on me and my son. But yeah.
But you've done this to your son. I mean, this is a consequence of your actions.
I don't know what to say.
Shamima Begum there speaking to ITV News. Now, on NBC's Today Show this morning regarding the U.S. case of Hoda Muthana, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo told Craig Melvin that Muthana is not welcome back in the United States.
There are now over 800 terrorists that are being held, foreign terrorist fighters that are being held in Syria today. She's just one of them. She is a terrorist. She's not a U.S. citizen. She ought not return to this country.
So she wasn't born here?
She may have been born here. She is not a U.S. citizen, nor is she entitled to U.S. citizenship.
Is that because she was the daughter of a diplomat and she was born here? Is that?
That's right.
That's Secretary of State Mike Pompeo on NBC's Today Show this morning. Now, Muthaana's family says that her father ended his diplomatic service prior to Muthaana being born, so that's why they are challenging the contention that she is not a U.S. citizen. They say that she is. Well, let's go to Jessica Trisco-Darden now. She joins us from Washington. She's a professor of international affairs at American University School of International Service, and she's also a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Her work focuses on the relationship between foreign aid and conflict, including terrorism and extremism. Jessica Trisco-Darden, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Also joining us today is Muhammad Fraser Rahim, Executive Director for North America of Quilliam International, a counter-extremism organization. He formerly worked for the Department of Homeland Security and Director of National Intelligence as an expert on violent extremism as well. Muhammad Fraser Rahim, welcome to you.
Thank you very much.
So Jessica Trisco-Darden, let me just start with you. What do you see are the risks of, I mean, the United States right now is not even entertaining the notion at all, but what are the risks of repatriating or bringing women like Methune back to the United States, Muthaana, even if they say they're willing to face justice?
Well, I think one concern that I have is that despite knowledge of these female terrorists and their associated children for many years, that the U.S. government has not developed sufficient policies to repatriate these women first, but more importantly, has not developed appropriate justice mechanisms. And there has been a significant gender bias in post-conflict justice more generally, and women like Hoda Muthaana are trying to game that system. So in part of the interview that you did not play, when she's initially asked if she should face justice, she talks about therapy, how she should go to therapy, how she wants to become a voice speaking out against ISIS. None of those solutions, right, address the reality that she incited individuals to commit violence against U.S. citizens.
So, Muhammad Fraser Rahim, respond to that here, because I hear what Jessica's saying. There's this tendency to sort of really reduce women's role in their radicalization and joining of ISIS to sort of these gendered narratives. What do you think about that?
You know, having been a former government counterterrorism analyst, now working with Quilliam, which is composed of former extremists themselves, including women and men, I've been able to see a sort of a full picture. And I think that what we see right now is terrorist groups seek to diversify their audience for recruitment. Women are certainly part of that. We've seen this within Boko Haram, al-Shabaab, ISIS, al-Qaeda. It doesn't really matter the particular terrorist organization. I think my colleague is right. What we have is an opportunity to put in place policies, and particularly de-radicalization efforts. I mean, right now we're working with a number of individuals who are former al-Qaeda, former extremists, and working to rehabilitate them. That journey is slow. That journey in and out of extremism is a long process that does not happen overnight. I think that what we saw with Hoda, as well as with Shamima Begum as well, are individuals who certainly are feeling the pressure. And that pressure to that they're realizing that, you know, life, it was not the utopian idea of an Islamic state that they might have imagined, real and or perceived. And they are now coming to the real grips of reality. And that grip of reality is that they have to be held accountable. And so I think we have an opportunity right now, and at least from my perspective, I think that we should allow the courts to bring them to justice, both in the United Kingdom as well as the United States, and allow that process to develop. And it will be a deterrent for others who see or have an interest to go elsewhere, whether it's a new location and anywhere else in the world. Mm. And I think that this will be an example for others to not go down this pathway.
Yeah. So, Jessica Trisco-Darden, I'm going to come back to you in just a second here. But Mohammed Fraser-Rahim, let me just play a little bit of tape for you, since we are now talking about, as well, about Shamima Begum, the British woman, the 19-year-old British woman now. You know, we're talking about they're coming to grips with the reality of what it meant to be part of the Islamic State here. But Begum herself, in some cases, in some interviews, isn't necessarily entirely repentant here, as far as I can hear. So here's a moment from just last week at the Syrian refugee camp where Begum is, and she spoke with Anthony Lloyd of the Times of London, and Shamima Begum told him what her life looked like after joining the Islamic State 4 years ago.
It was like a normal life, the life that they show on the propaganda videos. You know, it's a normal life. But every now and then there are bombs and stuff.
Did you ever see executions?
No, but I saw a beheaded head in the bin.
In the bins?
Yeah.
What was that like when you first saw that? These are the heads of captives?
Yeah. Didn't faze me at all.
So that's Shamima Begum telling a British reporter that she saw beheaded heads in bins, and it didn't faze her at all. So Mohammed Fraser-Rahim, just help us understand this a little bit. I mean, is this the voice of someone who says, I now want to be completely de-radicalized, let me home?
You know, I think that she's certainly speaking to an audience who she's seeking to, she gets a sympathetic ear. I think there are other examples. If we go back to 2015, Mohammed Quais said that he fled or he wanted to go to the Islamic State because he thought quote unquote, he was curious. Christopher Clark last month, the African-American individual who was picked up in the Islamic State, he wanted to see what the group was all about. So I think there's this propaganda. There is this imagery. There is the online tools that are utilized by these extremist groups, and they seek to lure in individuals. The same way that we engage on gang prevention, the same way that we engage on drug prevention, is the approach that we should be engaging on Islamist efforts that seek to recruit our brothers, our sisters, our friends, our neighbors who live all across the United States. And so I think we have to really come up with a real world, comprehensive, real time effort to put policies in place, and particularly dealing with de-radicalization. I mean, right now, the fact that I'm still very much engaged with rehabilitation right here in the United States, my colleagues in the United Kingdom, and the fact that I'm engaged in this work even outside of government shows that this isn't going away anytime soon, and that I can tell you that it's only going to gather. We're only going to probably see more. Certainly, the numbers are much less. We're seeing probably under 100 Americans who are former ISIS, but we're dealing with thousands in the European theater. So, you know, there's something to learn from that. I think certainly in liberal Western democracies, we can certainly exchange notes and compare.
Yeah.
But we've seen a number of young other individuals. I mean, we look at Jalen Deshaun Young down in Vicksburg, Mississippi, Hoda, certainly. And then we even saw an FBI translator, Daniela Green, along with Shannon Maureen Connolly
right.
in Denver.
Right. So, but Jessica Trisco-Darden, let me turn back to you here, because I still want to focus on the specifics around these cases. And we can talk about the process and efforts around de-radicalization in a minute, and we'll return to that. But I was looking at some thoughts from other experts in the area of extremism, and there was this quote in the New York Times from Seamus Hughes, deputy director of the George Washington University Program on Extremism. And he says there are, quote, thousands of legitimate reasons to question the sincerity of appeals of women such as Muthana and Begum. And I'm just wondering if you agree with that and what some of those reasons might be.
Yes. So I also read that New York Times article that quoted Seamus Hughes, and I agree with everything that he said in that article. And I think there are important parallels that we can point to. So, for instance, if we look to the end of World War II, approximately 500,000 women left Germany to participate in the expansion of the Third Reich into Eastern Europe. Yet, after the war ended in East Germany, only 220 Nazi women were tried for murder or accessory to murder in the 45 years following the end of World War II. These were women who actively participated in the murder of Jews. These were women who were ideologically committed to Nazism, and yet they were absent almost entirely from the justice system. And in the trials that did occur, women would be asked if they were pressured by their husband or other men when they shot and killed Jews in cold blood. Their motives were attributed to personal desires and emotions, like being blinded by love. If they cried, it went into the court record. And I think the same thing is happening today, that women know that if they craft a sympathetic narrative, that they'll be treated differently by the justice system. And I think this is actually something that's been explicitly noted. I think Huda Muhtana has been a lot more successful in generating sympathy than Shamina Begum. But I think that's just because she has a better understanding of how the U.S. justice system works.
Well, so this would be in cases that of women who actually are quote-unquote, brought to justice here. But I'm also wondering about, you know, the United States has repatriated, under 60 or so, according, again, to the George Washington program, mostly men who traveled to Syria and fought on behalf of the Islamic State. But for these women, they're not even considering repatriating them. Why is that? Can you help us understand the difference there?
Absolutely. I think it's because women's roles in these sorts of groups are often quite ambiguous. So my latest book, which came out this month, Insurgent Women, Female Combatants in Civil Wars, compares women in ISIS and other Salafi jihadi groups to women in more traditional rebel groups, like, for instance, the PKK in Turkey or the FARC in Colombia, many of which are also designated terrorist organizations. And what we see is that the role that women play in these terrorist groups varies widely. And I think it's very difficult in these particular instances to pin down what crimes these women may or may not have been involved in. So, for instance, I have yet to see an interview that in which a journalist asks either of these women, did you have a slave, right? More than 6,000 Yazidis were enslaved by ISIS. Mm-hmm. No one is pushing these women on the crimes that they may or may not have committed. I think thanks to work of Seamus Hughes and others, we have evidence that Huda Muhtana was engaged in incitement to violence. She declared that, you know, the United States was our greatest enemy. But that evidence is very, very hard to track down. And I think that's why if we repatriate these women, they will be brought to justice under an American system, but we don't necessarily have that evidence. And I think that's something that Canada in particular has struggled with. In the UK, less than 10% of those who have been repatriated have faced criminal justice, because that evidence is very difficult to track down in the kind of complex war zone.
I see. Very interesting. Mohammed Fraser Rahim, would you like to respond to that?
No, I would agree. I think that I think we are dealing with the reality of women's roles who aren't just working in sort of domestic functions. And I think we have another number of examples throughout the world. Certainly, even in the African theater, we've seen various groups, particularly Al-Shabaab and also Boko Haram, who have utilized women, many who were covered in hijab, who've been able to move IEDs and being able to carry out those actions, and particularly in disguise. And so that's we've seen precedents to this as well. I think that I imagine our intelligence professionals are certainly gathering information. And I think as we speak right now, we'll probably get they're gathering information that shows probably a lot more details about their role, whether it's Shamima within the British intelligence system or certainly Huda within the American intelligence system as well. I think that in time we'll gather a lot more detail, and I think that the role of women certainly will show that their involvement as well.
Well, so tell us a little bit more about that, Mohammed, because you did work at Homeland Security and with the Director of National Intelligence here. Is there an opportunity through repatriation and having Huda Muthanna face justice for intelligence gathering on the Islamic State? Could she provide some kind of important insight or information that could provide useful in counterterrorism operations?
Definitely. I mean, the majority of my career was at the National Counterterrorism Center, which is the clearinghouse of counterterrorism issues for the U.S. government. And so as a former analyst, this would have been an opportunity to get as much detail as possible on the inner workings of ISIS. Particularly, there was a battalion of women involvement. Again, this is something it would be an intelligence question. And I think that there's a number of individuals who are certainly trying to get to those really nitty-gritty questions. I think that we will be using this as an opportunity, particularly the broader U.S. government, I think, to debrief her and find out any sort of ties that she might have had with other women and certainly broader networks as well. And so I think that allowing that process to take place and certainly allowing her to come back to the United States would facilitate such efforts.
Right.
I think in
can
addition...
Can I just... Mohammed, I'm sorry to jump in here, but we've got about 30 seconds before we have to take a quick break. And Jessica, I just wanted to get your quick response to that. Is there an intelligence opportunity here that's worth the risk?
I think it's interesting that Ms. Muthanna has not publicly identified her most recent husband, and we should be asking serious questions about that.
Okay. All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break here. We're talking about women from the United States, from the United Kingdom, from France and other Western countries who go to join the Islamic State and now say they want to come home. What do you think? Is it worth the risk? Are there opportunities here? Or is it too dangerous to let them back in? This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about women who traveled to Syria to join the Islamic State. And now, as the Islamic State is collapsing, they're asking to come back home to the United States, to the United Kingdom and other Western countries, sometimes with children that they've had while being Islamic State militants. I'm joined today by Jessica Trisco-Darden. She's professor of international affairs at American University's School of International Service and a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute as well. Mohammed Fraser Rahim also joins us. He's executive director for North America of Quilliam International, a counter-extremism organization. And Jessica and Mohammed, if I may, let's go straight to the phones. Jerry is calling from Lebanon, Kentucky. Jerry, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you. My response to all this about letting anybody come back who left this country, I don't care if they're teenagers, male or female, even if they're not even teenagers yet, these people will fall for anything, any kind of ideology at any point along the line, as far as I'm concerned, and they can't be trusted ever again. I don't care if they do go through some sort of a program for retraining. There have been too many people to give their lives and put their lives on the line and who have been maimed and what have you. And from this country and a lot of other countries, it's just ludicrous that they should be let back in.
Yeah. Well, Jerry, thank you so much for your call. Mohammed Fraser Rahim, let me turn to you with that, because we also have a listener on Twitter, someone calling themselves John/Owl Whisperer, who's saying, I have to be honest, not feeling anything. The Islamic State had videos of decapitating hostages. Who sees that and says, oh, I want to be part of that? I just can't find any empathy for them. So, Mohammed, how would you respond to that?
Well, I think that, you know, the issue I was reflecting on, the amount of time, particularly with the U.S. government spending interest or spending time on looking to repatriate individuals who are former Gitmo detainees. And we have requested various nation states throughout the world to take in individuals all over the world, whether in the African continent, European nations, or in Latin America.
I mean, the president just recently tweeted exactly that, that he's encouraging all these nations to take back their citizens. Yeah.
So I think it's an opportunity for the United States too, as well, to say we have to do our part as well. And I don't speak in absolute terms per se, but I would say that I think that we should at least consider bringing these individuals back, because we do have an issue in the United States of individuals, particularly who have been radicalized, who have sought to leave the United States and fight for Al Qaeda and certainly for the Islamic State. And so I think that this, and at least from my estimation, I think that we should consider this, and particularly if I was advising government officials at this time, I would say that this is an opportunity for us to allow us to learn from these individuals who have traveled to these locations, because I think we'll probably gain more insight. Certainly, the political conversation is playing out, but I think that the reality, we need individuals who are de-radicalized and rehabilitated, and certainly not just when they come home and they're immediately sort of giving us good information. I think while they're in prison, I mean, one of the difficult tasks too as well is individuals who are locked up, on average, most of academic research says it's 13.5 years. A lot of individuals aren't getting the rehabilitation that they need while they're in prison.
Yeah. Well, sorry, Mohana. We just have a lot of callers who've been patiently waiting. So let me just go to another one. Let's go to Brittany, who's calling from Baltimore, Maryland. Brittany, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
No problem, Brittany. Go ahead.
So I've actually lived in both the U.S. and the U.K. for long periods of time, and I'm familiar with both cases. I think that there's a major problem going on here. I don't think that I really have much sympathy for these women, but then again, judging this, the idea that us as individuals should listen to their interviews, judge it for ourselves, and that public opinion should be what determines whether they come back or not, I think is ridiculous. We have laws and systems, and that is what distinguishes us from the Islamic State. If they don't work well enough, then let's fix them. We've already got hundreds of thousands of women who have been impacted by rape who don't get to see justice because of our broken justice system. Then let's fix that. The other thing is that the British government revoked Ms. Begum's citizenship because they decided that she must be a citizen of Bangladesh and she should go back there. First of all, Bangladesh says she's not a citizen, but also, how is it fair to make Bangladeshis have to deal with her when they have more people dying from terrorism every year than the Brits do? I think, you know what? These people were radicalized in their own countries. We have to deal with them. They're our problem more than they are anyone else's.
Yeah. Brittany, thank you so much for your call. Jessica Trisco-Darden, let me turn to you on that. Two important points Brittany's bringing up. First of all, is this an opportunity, via bringing these women back and, you know, having them face justice, putting them on trial, whatever manner they might work their way through the criminal justice system here, to demonstrate once again the rule of law and as it functions, hopefully functions appropriately in liberal democracies? Is that not sort of an important opportunity?
I think one related question is who has jurisdiction. And so some of the governments that are involved in Europe and elsewhere have made the claim that it should be the Iraqi and Syrian states that should have jurisdiction over some of these men and women, and that they should receive trials in local courts. And so, for instance, Iraq has been pretty swift in sentencing many of these women associated with ISIS to death. Human rights campaigners have raised, you know, legitimate concerns about whether there was sufficient legal representation and such. But I think that that is a position that certain governments have taken, and I think that it is a justifiable position in many senses. But there are also other options, right, including detention in third countries, which was mentioned, but also the establishment of an international judicial process, for example, like the former International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, that can kind of mediate these competing claims by various states as to who should bear responsibility for trying these women. I'd also like to point out, in response to Brittany's second point, that there was very little outrage when the United Kingdom stripped the citizenship of roughly 100 other nationals. The difference here is that this is a young woman with a child, and that is garnering much, much more immediate attention than those 100 other cases. And I think that, again, this is another instance of gender bias in how we treat foreign terrorist fighters.
Interesting. So it's a follow-up question to that, though, Jessica, is since there is so much attention around these particular cases regarding these women, is stripping them of their citizenship perhaps risking making them into a kind of political martyr for use for, you know, further propaganda via the Islamic State?
It's really interesting. Kim Cragen raised attention to this issue in an article she wrote a few years ago when she called it the foreign fighter hot potato problem, right? No one wants to deal with these men or women, but women especially. And so there's this been an attempt kind of in the international community to try and pass the buck to other states. In the particular case of Shamina Begum, you know, I can't speak for the Bangladeshi or UK governments, but I think if the UK had first mover advantage there and stripped her citizenship before the Bangladeshi government could make their case, then, you know, there is a legal process in the United Kingdom to adjudicate that. But I do think, you know, citizenship comes with responsibilities. It comes with rights. It also comes with responsibilities. And so if you're going to advocate for, you know, killing your compatriots, I think that's a big concern. If we look at the language that Huda Muhtana is using in her interviews, she refers to the Americans. Right. Uh-huh. I've never heard of an American refer to the Americans before. She's not addressing her neighbors. She's not addressing her compatriots. She's, you know, talking about some population over there that she does not feel she's part of.
So, Mohammed Fraser Rahim, would you like to respond to that?
I mean, I agree with her. I think that, you know, we're dealing with the situation right now where and I think for me, what makes both of these situations, both in the U.S. and U.K., very interesting is that we have children involved. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's sort of the uniqueness of how to navigate this. The fact that these are women who have carried out crimes, who've been married to individuals who were involved with the Islamic State is one thing. But the fact that they are children who, at least from international sort of agreements, that there's a responsibility from the nations that they came from to at least do right by them. And so I think that that is something that legal scholars, the courts, analysts like all of us are trying to wrestle of how to best navigate this. And only in time we'll tell where this will go.
Well, but can I get you to respond to something, directly respond to something that Jessica just said about how, you know, in interviews, Huda Muhtana is saying the Americans, you know, still sort of using language that's othering the nation that she wants to return to. I mean, you have deep experience in de-radicalization. Is this the speech of someone who's ready to be de-radicalized?
I think that she's still in the battlefield, if you will. She is geographically, physically in the location in which she has been exposed to an ideology for years. And so no one loses that sort of framing overnight. And from the experiences of individuals that we are working with, we have worked with, men and women, that process takes time. And so I imagine right now she is dealing with conflicting perspectives of what she should do. She's wanting to leave this location, certainly potentially because of her child. But as another issue, I think that she is wrestling through what happened for the past few years in my life. And that appeal, and particularly you look at a magazine like Inspire or Dabiq, two English language publications of Islamic State and Al-Qaeda, they were using English-speaking individuals to appeal to this constituency. So these guys, men and women, were very much interested in conveying a message that would resonate with them. And I think that what we see is, particularly with Hoda, is someone who is, at a minimum, still very much indoctrinated into that mindset. And I wouldn't imagine this will take place overnight.
Yeah.
And this is from personal experiences.
Well, let's go to Hector, who's calling from Tampa, Florida. Hector, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for having me. So the issue that I'm having, the person does not become de-radicalized overnight. It's not a process where if they go to a therapy session or if they go to a school or a camp, it doesn't happen overnight. Once they're radicalized, to have them change that mindset requires a little more than going to some session. And who's to say? And I told this to the other call. To have them come into this country, all they're going to do is become a burden to society where we have to pay for their health care and pay for their living expenses and pay for their education and pay for everything that they, would reap from just coming back into this country. And B, who's to say that they're not going to create or cause another terrorist attack? No one can say that for sure. If this person's not being truthful from the very beginning, if you honestly want to come back into our country, you have to. You have to be honest. You have to tell them what the investigators want to know. And you have to tell them, the whole process of how you got radicalized. And a lot of them would not want to share that.
Hey, Hector, can I just ask you a quick question? I'm seeing here that you told our call screener that you have experience in counterterrorism. Is that right?
Yes, ma'am. I did 21 years with the New York City Police Department as the lieutenant in charge of the demographics unit.
So 20 years, meaning over the time of 9/11.
Correct.
Okay. So tell me just in another quick minute here, Hector, I mean, it sounds like you're coming at this from the point of view of experience, but are you saying that we should or shouldn't allow her back? I mean, what if we did allow her back, put her on trial, put her in jail?
We should never allow her back into our country. Even if you put her in jail, it's going to cost the U.S. taxpayers about $50,000 to $80,000 a year to house her in a U.S. prison. Mm. Keep her in that camp that she's in, send her to another country where she has allegiance to, and let them deal with it.
Yeah.
Have her come back into our country and release her after 3 or 4 years, it's not going to do anything but create problems
right.
for us down the line.
Well, Hector, thank you so very much for your call. Let's get a different view. Let's go to Ben, who's calling from Yellow Springs, Ohio. Ben, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for having my call.
Go ahead, Ben.
You know, it seems to me I couldn't disagree with Hector Moore, despite not having counterterrorism experience. It would seem to me that, though you can't guarantee anybody won't commit a terrorist attack, people who have gone and lived among people in the Islamic State, have lived in the Islamic State and want to return home, are about as unlikely to commit a terrorist attack as anybody. In fact, if I had to say that a person could turn into a fierce patriot through some ineluctable process, it would have to be joining an organization antithetical to everything America stands for and then discovering that she hates it. And as I believe you just pointed out, she could be put in jail. She could be put in prison. She could be put on trial for this.
Well, Ben, I'm going to take it back from you there because we've just got a minute and a half left to go in the program. But thank you so much for your call. Jessica Trisco-Darden, let me turn back to you. You heard a whole variety of opinion there just then. But I want to get a final thought from you in about 30 seconds here. What do you think the next steps ought to be in these particular cases with these women?
I think that there is a significant security threat posed here. So in my book, Insurgent Women, I detail how, for instance, female FARC fighters in Colombia are less likely to leave the group than men. And I think that, as was previously mentioned by Dr. Fraser Rahim, right, these are women who have been in the group for an extended period of time. In some instances, they're still very ideologically committed, as Shamina Begum appears to be, and we need to take these women very seriously as a security threat and obviously abide by the laws of our nation. And I think that's what the State Department is currently doing.
Yeah. And Mohammed Fraser Rahim, you just got about 20 seconds to your last thought to you today.
We have been we de-radicalized the youngest person in U.S. history, Mohammed Hassan Khalid, at 15 years old. And now he's out and thriving and involved. And I think that working more with individuals who have gone down this pathway, men and women, will help us gather insights of how to confront this in the future. And so I think we have to use this as lessons learned and hopefully good practices for the future.
Well, Mohammed Fraser Rahim, Executive Director for North America of Quilliam International, a counter-extremism organization, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Jessica Trisco-Darden, Professor of International Affairs at American University School of International Service and a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, thank you so much for being with us today as well.
Thank you for the opportunity.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken? Wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.